loop. You find out, is it peaking clockwise or peaking counterclockwise? You leave it in that position, you turn it off, you open up the cover, and you look inside. You'll probably discover that your variable capacitor is set to bare minimum. All the plates completely unmeshed, and you got nothing left to go. In that case, it tells you exactly what's going on. You didn't hit resonance. So you, in that case, you've got to lower the amount of inductance of the coil. You've got to find out what the stray capacitance is. Is there something wrong with the tube? The tube may have been damaged, for instance, and you've got an extra little whisker of wire hanging inside between the grid and the plate, and there's a lot of extra capacitance that didn't quite short out. Or you've got a neutralizing capacitor that somebody set to maximum by mistake. Or somebody dented the cage of the shielding of the plate circuit so that now the cage is closer to the plate of the tube and adding extra capacitance. Something happened to knock it out of resonance. A parallel kilowatt amplifier, a K2RIW parallel kilowatt amplifier, if that plate strip line circuit does not hit resonance, you've got nothing coming out of there. It'll drive you crazy until you realize what the heck's going on. So that's my guess as to what it was. He called it the output filter. Well, the Pi L tank circuit is both a resonator and a filter. There's also the possibility that it also has, to meet all the FCC specs, a cascaded low-pass filter. And the low-pass filter could have had a failure, so that it doesn't have throughput, doesn't have resonance, adds extra capacitance or whatever. So was it really the harmonic reducing low-pass filter that's after the Pi L network, or was it an error in the Pi L circuit itself, which is also a filter? I mean, he gave you a very innocuous sounding answer. Somebody could ask you who was Hitler, and you'll say, well, he was a paper hanger that lived in Germany. As I said before, there's a lot more to that story. Well, the fact that your filter, your output filter was not working correctly, that's the beginning of the story. I, for one, would be curious about more. But sounds to me like you're on the mend. Sounds to me like you're going to be making some watts, Steve. And sounds like all's well. And maybe when you get it back and you open it up, you may see something visual inside. Maybe the old filter got arced over because somebody ran an open circuit by mistake, forgot to put the antenna on there. So back to you, Steve. KC2MDP. More power to you. KQRIW in the tech net.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, when you gave me this answer, I was a little bit befuddled myself, you know, saying to myself, okay, you know, there's got to be a little bit more to the story. But I figured, you know, I was just happy to get this thing back after a month and a half. And like I said, hopefully this week, you know, it'll show up, and I'll hook it up, and hopefully everything will be all okay. Just one quick thing, a high SWR, I mean, you know, the highest SWR I had here when I was testing this thing was maybe 2 to 1, you know, maybe 2.1 to 1. That couldn't have any effect on this thing, you know, blowing this supposed output filter. Could it affect you?
Not a chance. When you talk about the swerve of that amplifier, I'm 99% sure, Steve, you're talking about input standing wave ratio. The standing wave ratio on the input network. It's either the cathode if it's a grounded grid amplifier, or it's the grid if it's a grounded cathode amplifier. It doesn't matter. Input standing wave ratio, that's what your driver circuit, maybe it's a Kenwood 820 or whatever it is that you're using as your exciter. Your exciter circuit is the only thing that sees the input visoir of your amplifier. And anything shy of 3 to 1 there, in my opinion, is not significant. As long as your driver amplifier is capable of tolerating that. You got to be a little bit careful here because some of the modern-day solid-state amplifiers start becoming unhappy at 2 to 1, and some of the really persnickety ones become unhappy at 1.5 to 1. They just go into a self-protect mode. They start cutting themselves back in power. They light up a warning light on the front panel, and so on. Some of them are really persnickety. Back in the old days, when we had a real tuning and loading control on our amplifiers, a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio at most phase angles was very tolerable. Now, the modern day amplifiers, unless you buy the antenna tuner that goes with it, they're kind of fussy. They really want 1.5 to 1, so to speak. So a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, if it was an antenna, the average amateur would lose a lot of sleep over that. shouldn't. It represents, worst case, half a decibel of loss, which is 1/12 of one S unit on a well-calibrated S meter. Well-calibrated S meter is supposed to be 6 dB per S unit. In other words, when you go from S8 to S9, if the meter is well-calibrated according to the standard, there should be a 6 decibel difference, 6 decibel increase when that guy does something so that the signal you receive goes from S8 to S9. 6 dB, which is 2 to 1 voltage. S9 is 50 microvolts. S8 is, by definition, 25 microvolts. So you were receiving 25 microvolts from him when he gave you an S8. You're receiving 50 microvolts from him when you get an S9. Twice voltage, because power is a function of voltage squared. Twice voltage is 4 to 1 power. 4 to 1 power is 6 decibels. That's why there's 6 decibels per S unit. It's a very handy scale system. So a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio represents half a dB of loss. I have used very successful antennas which have a standing wave ratio as high as 20 to 1. My 20 meter antenna, which was a trap dipole, at the frequency I've used it at, you've heard the story many times, had a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. My tuning and loading controls of my particular amplifier could tolerate that, and the thing worked like a charm. I'll admit that whenever I would QSY a little bit in frequency, I'd have to readjust the controls a whole lot. A high standing wave ratio tends to be high in Q, that antenna. So standing wave ratio, as you can tell, is a controversial subject. You say any of these things that I just said on the 20 meter band and the phone band on a Saturday afternoon, and you're going to get 10 people jumping down your throat saying, oh no, no Steve, that's not the way it works. And you'll hear a whole bunch of theories of guys saying, well, I added another 8 wavelengths of cable to my feed line, and my standing wave ratio went from 2.5 to 1 down to 1.3 to 1. People will say things like that. They can say it. They, with their particular defective SWR meter, they may have seen it happen. They developed some kind of a crazy faith over that. It became a truth, unquote, quote truth, unquote. And so they believe it to be the gospel from then on, the emis, and it isn't. It's because of poor directivity of their standing wave ratio meter. You can get all kinds of readings. If your standing wave ratio meter doesn't have high directivity, when you're in the forward mode, it's leaking some of the signal from the reverse mode. When you're in the reverse mode, when you look in the trying to measure the VISWA, it's also measuring some of the power going forward. And the forward power and the reverse power are voltages that are adding and subtracting from each other. And depending on what phase angle, which is length of cable, what phase angle is coming back from the antenna, you can get all kinds of readings. Cyclic readings as you keep changing the length of the cable. It'll go up and down, and you plot that, and you'll plot a beautiful sine wave of standing wave ratio, which is a ratio on top of a ratio, if you think about it. So there's lots and lots of misconceptions on this one. So when is the standing wave ratio high enough to be of alarm? That's a function of what you're doing. If it's a solid-state amplifier without an antenna tuner, you'd like it to be 1.5 to 1 or better. If you've got a very tolerant rig, maybe you can tolerate 2 to 1. If you've got a very wide-range antenna tuner, 10 to 1 standing wave ratio is not bad, as long as your feed line is reasonably low in loss. If you've got a highly lossy feed line and a high standing wave ratio, then you're going to be burning up quite a bit of power in the feed line because the power is bouncing back and forth multiple times and going through the loss multiple times and starts adding up. Input impedance of an amplifier, an afterburner, 2 to 1, 2.5 to 1, 3 to 1 standing wave ratio is not unusual. In some cases, not alarming. But if you care about it, you can tweak that circuit on that particular band switch for that particular band and bring it back down if you want to. It may be something to do with the state of the tube. You'll also notice that the input standing wave ratio of most of these tubes does go up and down a little bit depending on how you tune the tuning and loading controls. So there's some interaction going on there. Now, in real amplifiers, there really is an output standing wave ratio. As a S parameter measured on a network analyzer, it's called S22. Input impedance standing wave ratio is called S11. S22 measures the output impedance of your amplifier. almost none of us ever measure output standing wave ratio of the amplifier. Yes, you've got the meter between the amplifier and the antenna, and the standing wave ratio meter, your bird watt meter, in the forward and reverse mode, whatever you're using as instrumentation, it's telling you what the antenna is doing. Logically, you would say, hey, it's midway between the antenna and the amplifier. Isn't it telling me something about the amplifier? Good question. Absolutely not. It's telling you nothing about that amplifier, with rare exception. To measure the output impedance, better known as the source impedance, better known as S22, of an amplifier, that's a complicated test. At times, that test has great value. If you and I were building that amplifier of yours, Steve, and we're building it for a military application, they might very well force you to do something called a load-pulling test or a cyclic Vizwar test. They may say that the amplifier will always produce more than, I'm going to pick a number, 500 watts. The amplifier must produce more than 500 watts when connected to a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio at all possible phase angles. In order to do that confirmation, you would create a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio with a trombone-like device between the amplifier and the 3-to-1 standing wave ratio load, and you would measure forward power produced by the amplifier at all possible settings of that trombone. That would be called a load-pulling test, and you really are measuring output impedance of the amplifier. Very different test. We amateurs usually don't care. It's a nice academic thing to know, but for our particular environment, it usually doesn't matter. In some cases of a military spec environment, it does matter. It allows them to predict all possible situations of that antenna, as long as the antenna is within performance, what real power is going to get out of that amplifier. Is it enough to do that communication from that airplane back down to the ground? Particularly if it was something like an IFF transmitter, identification friend or foe, that transmitter better put out the right power. If it doesn't, and that's what's identifying you as friendly versus foe, if that transmitter doesn't put out the right power, there is a certain probability you will be considered a foe and you will be shot out of the sky. It has happened. I have heard of a case where a man, a pilot on an aircraft, military aircraft, in a theater of war, his instrument panel lit up saying that his IFF transmitter had failed. It was not putting out any power at all. He was about to come back to the carrier, but he was not able to identify himself as a friendly. He knew there was a probability he's going to be shot out of the sky, and he didn't want that to happen. He hollers Mayday over the radio, tells everybody where he is, and ditched the airplane. Parachuted into the water and said, come get me. Turns on his portable receiver, his portable radio transmitter receiver, with the locator beacon on it, and the helo comes and picks him up. He didn't want to take the chance of having something really nasty being fired at him because the IFF didn't fail. So in that case, you can see whether or not the transmitter in the worst-case situation can put out the right power is extremely important. It's a life-or-death situation. You ain't anywhere near there, Steve. Don't worry. I shouldn't be giving you all this bad news. And have fun with that amplifier. Let us know how it works when you get it. KC2, Mike Delta Papa. I know I gave you a lot of information you didn't ask for. K2LIW on the TechNet. One of my favorite subjects. Rich recognized, but Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, thank you for the information, Dickie. I just want to make sure that I don't get this thing back and, through fault of my own with a little bit high SWR. Basically, where I'm operating this amp, the SWR is about 1.2, but when I go a little bit higher in frequency, in the FM mode of 6 meters, if I so desire, that's when the SWR starts to pick up. But I just want to make sure I don't want to make this amplifier unhappy again and have another 2 month wait. And it is a solid state amplifier. I wish it was a tube amplifier. That's what I really would like to have. But unfortunately, this is what I had to settle for. Back to you, Dick.
On a quick break, Steve, when you go to the FM portion of the band, how high does your SWR go? You said it starts picking up. What's your definition of pickup?
Well, I didn't push it too far with this amp. I'd say it starts picking up probably about 50 5,500, 5,600, and it probably picks up, like I said, it'll go to 2 to 1, and if I bring it up even a little higher, it starts going up to, you know, 2.5 to 1, and, you know, I never really to the far end of the band, but I'd say probably far end of the band is probably about a 3 to 1, this one. This antenna is basically cut, you know, for the sideband portion of a 16 spectrum.
Okay, as a solid-state amplifier, the high end of the band being a 3 to 1 would be pushing it. 2 to 1, it may not give you full performance, but any reasonable amplifier is not going to blow itself up with a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio. That's half a dB of potential loss. I will admit it's a reflected power of 9.5 dB down. Let's call it 10 to 1 to round it off. Put out 100 watts, 10 watts is coming back. Put out a kilowatt, 100 watts is coming back. When you're at the 2 to 1 standing wave ratio place, just a little bit more than that. 9.5 dB is the real number, so I'm going to guess with a kilowatt of output, you would have a reflective power from the antenna of something like 110 watts, which at first doesn't sound significant, except for the fact you've got to calculate standing wave ratio as a voltage phenomenon. When you figure out the watts of what's coming back versus the watts of what's going out and convert both of them into a voltage and then take the ratio of that voltage, you'll find out it's exactly a 3 to 1 ratio. In other words, the return voltage is exactly 0.3333 of the voltage that went out. That is a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio by definition. And that represents some amount of power, which is in the vicinity of 1/9 or 1/10 the power output being reflected. See what Rich got to say. N2EO, K2LIW, in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2LIW, TechNet. Limark, N2EO. But I was going to two things. So I was going to suggest to Steve, if he wants to get some real power out on 6, I haven't done it, but I remember there were articles in QST on taking the Heathkit SB200, which used 572Bs, or the SB220, which used a pair of 3500s. What they did was ripped out the tank circuit and the input circuit. They tell you how to do it, and they put a new tank circuit in and a new input circuit, cut to 6 meters. And it's pushing the tubes. The 3500s, I think, will go up to a maximum of about 60 megahertz. I'm not sure about the 572Bs. I think you're approaching maximum on 6 as far as frequency. But it's a reasonably inexpensive way to, if you don't want to homebrew and you don't want to buy, it's sort of halfway. You can get an SB200 and an SB220 used, rip out the guts and convert it to 6. The other thing that I was going to recommend on this subject and other subjects, I mean, you've mentioned the book, they dubbed it the West Coast Handbook, the book by Bill Orr, W6SAI, put out by Howard Sams. Well, the book is out of print, but I found some copies on Amazon.com. I have sitting downstairs the 22nd edition. They went up to the 23rd edition. Bill Orr passed away a number of years ago, but that's one hell of a good book on the subject. Back to that N2EO.
Yeah, I do remember. I have a copy of that. I'm not sure which edition it is. And it does have some very nice transmitter circuits. Bill Orr did specialize more in transmitter circuits, amateur design transmitter circuits, particularly West Coast design, many of them using IMAC tubes, than any of the other handbooks. So a person who's thoroughly equipped, say 15, 20 years ago, owned both handbooks, the East Coast handbook, the ARO amateur radio handbook, as well as the West Coast Bill Orr handbook. I think one of them is called Handbook for Amateur Radio, and I'm not quite sure. They all have very similar sounding titles. And so with both books, you've got a lot of information, particularly on transmitters. So what standing wave ratio is tolerable is a darn interesting question. Depends on the environment. Solid-state amplifiers are much more stringent on that one. Mel, what kind of email have you had this week? And was it on Smith chart? Was it on decibels? with it on some of the other highfalutin subjects we've discussed. And let me think now. Let me make a quick question to Paul first. Paul, are we keeping you up beyond your bedtime? What you want? Maybe you want to give your report first. WS2F, better ask you that one, Paul. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, I'm listening, so I'll stand by. Not a problem.
Okay. Glad we're not interfering with your beauty sleep, because I know you gotta work tomorrow.
So do I.
But lucky for me, I'm a little bit independent, and I can set my hours. Mel, when he was working, he had to be there at 7:30 every day. And he's thinking of retiring. K2KEY. What kind of mail this week, Mel? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Can I make one comment, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Rich.
Just wanted to recommend anybody interested in that book, you can go on Amazon.com, look up the Radio Handbook by William I. Orr, spelled O-R-R, call letters W6SAI, put out by Howard Sams. Very, very good book. It's now out of print, but there's quite a number available on Amazon.com for $30 or $40 a copy. Back to you, Dick. Turn it over to Mel.
Yeah, $30 or $40 a copy, in my opinion, it's worth it. Rather good book. Even though it's a little bit on the older side, many of these tubes are still in use today. As long as you're a person who doesn't have aversion to tubes, you like thermionic emission devices, hollow state devices. And tubes, by the way, have a lot more gain, and they're a lot more forgiving, and they've got much simpler power supplies than solid state. That's the good news. And most of the tube circuits have got a fantastic output tuning range as to what the tuning and loading controls will tolerate for output standing wave ratio. The antenna tuner is already built into most tube amplifiers. So don't discount tube amplifiers, even though you think this is a solid-state age. When it comes to receivers, without a doubt, this is a solid-state age. When it comes to transmitters, vacuum state devices are going to be around for a long time when it comes to the higher frequencies and the higher power. K2KEY. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Mel.
This is K2KEY. Yeah. In fact, I have a number of William Orr's books. I just pulled out one just to, you know, take a glance at it. It's the 16th edition. I like that one very much because it had a lot of elegant amplifiers in there using a lot of tubes, especially from World War II. That's 4125A, 4400, 304TLs, and all that. Those are the tubes I grew up with. And, Rich, if you need it, you know, I was going to tell you about, you know, shunting meters. A very good source of shunt resistance is from an old toaster. I tore out the nichrome, element from an old toaster, and I used that as a source of shunt material for meters, you know, to make the shunt for changing the shunt around. I guess that's what you want to do. You want to add a shunt, and you're going to find it's going to only be very, very small amount of resistance there. So have you ever used that Dick, nichrome from a old toaster? Over.
W2SR recognized. I've used nichrome wire. I've used wire running resistors I've taken apart, but I've never used a toaster. W2SR, I think it was. I should know you. Start off with your name first, sir, and then proceed.
Hi, Dick. It's Bob, W2OSR. I said it too fast. That's what you're using. No, I was just thinking of something I did to make a meter shunt a while back. Over.
Tell us about that.
It was when I was in the Army, and I wanted to get a meter to work into a battery charger I was building. I took some of the communication wire that we used for telephones. That wire had several strands of copper in it and also several strands of steel wire. I made a shunt out of the steel wire, over.
Very nice. Any trouble soldering to that steel wire? Did you have to use tinner's fluid to get a good contact?
I don't think I thought I'd do it. I think I was able to get it under the screw terminals on the meter.
Yeah, that's you got to be a little careful with that, because as the resistance, the contact resistance on those screw terminals varies, your shunt apparent resistance can change. As and say, for instance, your terminals of the meter might be made out of brass, your shunt resistor is made out of steel, and steel and brass are considered dissimilar metals, depending on the local humidity and salt spray and anything else that might be present, the contact resistance can easily change. The safe way to make a shunt resistor would be to choose the right length of the material, solder a great big lug onto it so you've got extremely good contact between the lug and the steel wire, if that's what your shunt resistance is made out of, and then the great big lug goes under the nut of the meter, and now you know you've got very good repeatable contact between the meter terminal and the lug, and by way of the solder, the lug to the steel. And therefore, you have a more reliable, repeatable, steady-state contact. But any change in that contact resistance because of dissimilar metals will start making a meter more sensitive, and it's going to start reading high, and at times it's going to confuse you. So you've got to be a little bit careful with that. For what you were doing, I think it was adequate, but for a long-term solution, there's ways of doing it a little bit better. So, Mel, back to you, K2KEY, K2IW TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. Well, the old Western meters, what they did, the shunt laid in the bottom of the big, like, case, and it was just clamped. Those brass screws that came through, they have the, you know, shape of the shunt in, like, a U-shape, and then they put these, I don't know how you can describe the washers. They're like washers with, like, little teeth in them that digs in to the material that the shunt was made out of. I don't know what the shunt was made out of, Dick. It was like a silverized material. I don't know. Do you know what the old shunts were made of in those meters, Dick, over?
I own some meters. Well, I own a shunting device, which reads, I think it's up to either 500 or 1,000 amperes. It's made out of brass. Got two great big terminals on the Bakelite block, big terminals left and right side. I think it's a 5/16, 14 thread or something like that to it, on these great big lugs on the side. In between is a strip of brass that's 3/4 of an inch wide, about 3/4 of an inch long. Looks like it's about 5,000 thick. A little bit of an oblong hole is drilled in the middle of the brass, and it's heavily clamped on each side. Clamped, soldered, whatever. By drilling a small hole of just the right size in the middle of that brass strip, this thing became a something like a 1,000 to 1. In other words, 1,000 amperes would give you 1 volt of output or something like that. 1,000 amperes per volt, 1,000 amperes per tenth of volt, I'm not sure. So it's a shunting device which allows you to measure high current in a circuit by measuring the voltage drop across it. It's a four-terminal device, so-called Kelvin connection. So in that case, all brass hardware and a brass wide strip is actually the shunt. I own some Western meters like you're describing, and I haven't taken them apart to look at what the shunt is like inside. You've piqued my curiosity, and I think I'm going to do that. And I want you to put your thinking cap on this week. How in the world can I get a 10-to-1 voltage divider on my 30,000-volt precision laboratory electrostatic voltmeter? That's a heavy challenge. That'll blow your mind with high voltage. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, I would think that you have to do some kind of a chemical-type action. Something that you would wet or something with some chemical. In other words, it would be maybe just like a cotton type of, piece of material, and that you spray it or something with it, and have to shunt it. How you calibrate it, I don't know, but I'm saying that's the only thing I can envision, you know, on a situation like that. But, yeah, getting back to the emails. Oh, yes, I've gotten some real good ones. I've tried to give a number of answers, ones that were legitimate, and the ones that, unfortunately, I will not answer because it's out of the realm of amateur radio or in the profession that we're in, and this constitutes a different situation. I keep getting them, but I will not start to say, not even want to comment on it. I promised this one young fella here to bring up his antenna situation, and it basically boils down to this. He lives in a situation where he has to put up a stealth antenna, and it must be really a stealth antenna, and he wants one for 80 meters, and a friend of his showed him an article that was printed in a periodical of amateur radio in Europe, and it was translated, and he gave me the translation, and he's asked me a number of times if I could make a comment on this antenna, Dick. So first, maybe we could start out with a description of this antenna, if you have the time right now, over.
Sounds like a good subject, and by the way, I can't think of the guy's name. I've got a copy of his book in which this guy travels all over the world and sets up antennas in 80, 40, 20, and 15 meters one at a time from his motel room, from his military base, and whatever. He's invented a zillion stealthy antennas, but the antenna doesn't show. It becomes part of the gutters and the downspout of the building. It becomes part of a flagpole. It becomes part of a guy wire. It becomes part of the stays of a sailboat. There's a zillion ways of making antennas, so it's a very good subject. Proceed, Mel.
Okay, this is KQKY. Well, in this case, he hasn't got any of those things available to him, except he's got a tree outside on this place where they live in, where they have very, very tight restrictions. And he was looking around for an antenna, and a friend of his gave him this article. Like I say, it was translated. And basically, here's what the article gave me, diagrams, everything here. So basically, I'll break it down for you. They took, it's actually called a ground plane antenna. It's actually a ground plane, so it's basically a vertical antenna. And what they do is, has the availability of a tree, and the tree does have limbs that are 60 feet in the air, and this antenna, what they did is they took a quarter wavelength of wire on for 80 meters, around 65 feet of wire, somewhere in that neighborhood, and they put it over a branch that was 60 feet in the air. And then they bent it over approximately 15 feet, was bent over, and then another 10 feet down. In other words, it's like an inverted L on top, so that the bottom piece hanging down from this branch of the 65 feet of wire comes down about 40 feet. And at that point, they put four quarter wavelength radios that meander through the tree, and the tree sits, or whatever, you know, tangled around in the, through the branches some way or another, and it's an elevated radio system, because according to the article, they said do not come closer than 5 feet with the radio to the ground. At that point is also, like I say, where the radio meets this vertical piece. That's the feed point. So he wants to know from me, do you think that this thing has any capability of putting the signal out on 80 CW? He says, I'd love to get on 80 CW. And if this could work, I could easily, I think, manage this type of antenna. He says, I cannot spread out a dipole or anything else, but this sounds like I can manage very close set up similar to what it described here.
Yeah.
But he says, I'd like to know, does it have any chance of really working? K2RIW in the group, K2KEY, what do you think, Dick?
I think it has the capability of working like a charm. All of the ground plane antenna, the vertical antennas with counterpoise, vertical antennas with ground plane radios we've discussed in the past, if you want really high efficiency, above 90%, when it's brought down to the ground, you have to lay down enough copper, enough radios. I've heard numbers anywhere from 4 radios up to 128 radios, but a lot of radios laid down, so that the RF energy thinks that it's operating against a sheet of copper. So you want the distance between the radios out of the perimeter to be a small enough number so that the RF energy thinks that it's a solid sheet of copper. And so keeping the distance between the tips of the radios below some number, I'm not sure what the number is, but maybe it's 0.05 wavelength, but some fraction of a wavelength, when it's small enough, the RF energy says the gap between those two is so small, the RF energy is not going to go down there, it's not going to heat up the soil, it's not going to make the worms warm in the wintertime, and therefore you're going to get high efficiency. Once you start raising your radial, the ground plane system, above Earth, all kinds of good things happen. The number of radios required starts going down real fast. Raise it high enough above the Earth, and the number of radios required to get very high efficiency goes down to one single radio. And when you've got that one single radio, you make it collinear with the radiator, and it's called a vertical half-wave dipole. That's the highest efficiency vertical antenna you'll ever get, a vertical half-wave dipole. It's thoroughly balanced. The upper half and the lower half work against each other in a symmetric manner. That's the good news. The bad news, on 80 meters, you need a 135-foot high tree, bare minimum. And so very few of us have got a tree that big. In California, with a redwood, sequoia, yeah, you can do that very nicely. Here on Long Island, in New York City, not likely. You could put up a tower and do it, and you could use the tower itself as a radiator. So as you raise the radiators above the ground, you get higher and higher efficiency with less and less ground plane radials. Because now, even though the RF energy can go between those radials out of the perimeter, the RF energy has to go way deep in between the radials, down far enough before it hits Earth. And you can see how it can't do that anymore. It can't couple the RF energy in the Earth, and the Earth in that situation without a ground plane radio system is kind of a dummy load, bulk resistive material. That's what Earth is. If your coil conductivity was as good as salt water, you wouldn't have that problem. But except for Barry, who occasionally gets the seawater washing over his property, and temporarily he's got the high ground conductivity, except for that situation, which gives him some other grief, by the way. He may have great 80-meter performance when he does that, but he's got some other problems at his house. But except for that situation, elevated ground plane radio is always good. And to have them in a tree, fantastic. At 80 meters, the tree is reasonably close to transparent to all of those signals. Yeah, a little bit of energy is coupled into the sap. But an 80-meter half-wave vertical dipole would have 8,500 square feet of effective capture area. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you looked at that antenna, you would see this great big black oval around the antenna, with the antenna going down the center of the oval, and it would be 8,500 square feet of area where it's capturing signal, putting it onto the wire of the dipole, coupling it down the feed line into the receiver, and it moves the S meter significantly. That's what's happening. And you can see now that the branches of your tree cast a shadow onto your antenna, but those branches are casting a shadow rather small compared to the 8,500 square feet of the real antenna. But one of the mechanisms by which you can say that the tree is not significant. It's not zero. A little bit of energy is coupled into the sap, and the sap is slightly conductive to RF energy. But with rare exception, the branches of the tree are not resonant if the tree happened to hit resonance at 80 meters on its vertical main trunk, the amount of energy you'd couple into the tree would increase. It wouldn't stop the operation, but you'd go from, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air, you'd go from 90% efficiency down to 75% efficiency, something like that. If the vertical dimension of the tree and the wet sap in it in the summertime just happened to hit resonance at 80 meters, it's still a small, effective area, except for the resonance phenomena, compared to what the real dipole is doing. But this gives you some of my feeling as to how I think that's an excellent antenna. K2KUI, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is KQI. Now, they're bending over approximately 15 feet. Well, let's see. Let me read it all the way it says here. The top bent over in its form of an inverted L. Now, this is a, let me get the wording correctly. If this is a ground plane with elevated radials, they call for, in this article, four radials, they suggest. Now, let's see. Would bending over that top into an inverted L, what effect would that have? I guess with the top loading, let me see. I guess you would get most of the vertical quarter wavelength. Try to picture this. I guess most of the current will flow in the lower half of this vertical quarter wavelength section, I would assume. And bending over the top into an inverted L would create, I guess, and the more you would bend, the longer that inverted L would be on top, I guess that would lower the frequency of the antenna. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
Sort of. When an antenna is built in full size, it's going to be a half wavelength long if it's a horizontal half wave dipole, or it's going to be a half wavelength long minus a little bit if it's a full half wavelength vertical antenna. I say minus a little bit because the bottom of the antenna, the tip of the bottom half, is close to Earth, adds a little bit of capacitance, and to hit resonance, you're going to have to shorten it a tiny bit. That's full half wave antenna. And in the case of a ground plane, you could say the bottom half has been spread out into this, into a cone that you eventually made into a flat surface. The radials go off, you know, parallel to the ground, but they are representing the second half of the antenna. The upper thing is called the radiator. Now, when it comes to a mechanically shrinking the antenna, there's a whole lot of techniques that can be deployed. You can put a loading coil at the bottom of the radiator that would make you shorten the radiator in order to reestablish resonance. It's one of the ways of mechanically shortening the antenna. The top of the antenna, you can put a bunch of little radials on it, considerably less than a quarter wavelength long, and that's called the top hat loading capacitor. It also will mechanically shorten the antenna significantly, and it'll still resonate. The wire of the antenna itself, you can wind it into a coil, that's that bottom loading coil. You can zigzag it in various ways. The upper 20, 30, 40, 50% of the antenna, you can bend it over at a right angle. You can loop it back on itself, which is a subset of zigzagging techniques. All of these techniques for mechanically shortening the antenna, properly deployed, will make a small change in the input impedance, which can be compensated. All of these techniques allow you to use less real estate, less length, still establish resonance, still get, in the ideal world, near 100% efficiency on radiation. That's a hard one to believe. You use good materials in the way you shrink down the antenna mechanically. Loading coil, top hat, zigzag, folding over, and whatever. And you can do that on the radials also, particularly on elevated ground plane radials. But you can do it on the radial, zigzag, top hat, loading on the end of the radial, loading coils at the base, all kinds of techniques. You can mechanically shorten the radials, mechanically shorten the radiator. And once you reestablish the impedance match, reestablish resonance, you will get extremely high efficiency. High 90s of percent if you use good materials. That's the good news. Every single technique for mechanically shortening the antenna will raise the Q. Q has four different definitions, but the one you and I care about most in this case is bandwidth of the antenna divided by center frequency. So when the Q goes up, and I got it backwards, center frequency divided by bandwidth, center frequency divided by bandwidth. When the Q goes up, the bandwidth of operation gets lower. Instead of the antenna on 80 meters, hitting standing wave ratio of 2 to 1, when you go 200 kc up and 200 kc down, when you start making mechanical shortening techniques, you maybe can only go 130 kc up and 130 kc down from center frequency before you hit 2 to 1 standing wave ratio. At first it sounds bad. As long as you've got a reasonably low feed line loss, as long as you've got a good antenna tuner or a good PI output tuning network, either which that has enough range of its tuning and loading controls, it will reestablish resonance. In order for an antenna of reasonable size, here the word reasonable size means we're not talking about a rhombic or a beverage, which is 10 wavelengths long. I call that a distributed antenna. As long as we're talking about a lumped antenna, something in the vicinity of a half wavelength or less, in those situations, you will resonate the antenna system first before it will radiate. Antenna system means radiator, ground plane, feed line, antenna tuner, transmitter. That system, a combination of components, will hit electronic resonance before it does any significant amount of radiation. So once you resonate a smaller and smaller mechanically sized antenna, but by whatever means, reestablish resonance. You can do it by using controls of your antenna tuner. You can do it by the loading coils. You can do it by zigzagging, folding over, top hat capacitors, all over the place. There's all kinds of ways you can mechanically shorten the antenna. The appropriate chapter of Antenna Engineering Handbook, written by Harold Wheeler, called Electrically Small Antennas, will tell you exactly what you're going to get. He figures out the volume of the antenna that's left after you shorten it. He'll tell you exactly how high the Q is going to become. He won all kinds of awards for making that prediction way back in the 40s and 50s when he was running the JASIC antenna, the Wheeler Antenna Laboratory. I think it was in Syosset, but I'm not sure. But anyhow, maybe that was JASIC in Syosset. Not sure where the Wheeler Laboratory. I think the Wheeler Laboratory may have been in St. James. Anyhow, within the laws of physics, it's not rocket science, so to speak. You're banging your head against the laws of physics. When you make an antenna electrically smaller, it will become more narrow in bandwidth. That's not bad. It just means that when you QSY, when you move to a new frequency, you will readjust those loading and tuning controls in order to reestablish resonance, because if you don't resonate, you're not going to radiate. Remember what I was telling you about the high Q of a VHF amplifier, a 6-meter, 2-meter, 432 amplifier. If that plate circuit doesn't hit resonance, because it's got very high Q, essentially no RF power comes out of that. Even though the tube is drawing current, it's driving the daylights out of the grid, everything is happy, it's making heat, it's making smoke and flames, but nothing's coming out, per se, RF energy, until you hit resonance. That same thing happens with an antenna. Your antenna will be resonated if you want it to radiate. And once it resonates, even if it's an infinitesimal dipole, you can make it a couple of feet long at 80 meters instead of 133 feet long if you're smart enough, and it will radiate with 90-some-odd percent efficiency. Put any substantial amount of power into it, because the Q is so high, it's going to become only a few kilohertz wide, very narrow, and because the Q is so high, the voltage rise of resonance is going to be significant. You try putting 500 watts into it, and the tips of the dipole are going to arc over with high voltage of discharge in air. Corona discharge, arc, spark, corona, you're going to get all of that. So that's the limiting function at a significant amount of power. Everyone assumes, I can go on 20 meters any day, I will find Guy saying that you make a shortened dipole by zigzagging it, loading coils, patch capacitors, whatever. They all tell you the effective area goes down. They all tell you the gain goes down. The performance goes down. They're using good common sense when they say that. They're dead wrong. You tell them the truth in this one, because each one of them has passed this story, this myth, this saga. They've been passing it back and forth between each other for years. They've all come to believe it. It has become the truth. Well, it ain't truth. You read the appropriate chapter of various respected authors who are traceable to the Bureau of Standards. The first one that comes to mind is the JASIC Antenna Engineering Handbook, but the real origin of this is the Krauss Antenna Book, 1950, McGraw-Hill. You look at his chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. He describes this phenomenon. Because the Q goes so high, even though it's small, because it goes through all of this fancy electronics to reestablish resonance, it reestablishes a high percentage of the original capture area. The effective capture area of the antenna is a huge amount larger than what your eye sees. Even the full half-wave dipole, made of a 14-gauge household wire, horizontally polarized. When the sun shines at high noon, that casts a shadow on the ground of approximately 1 square foot. When that antenna resonates, it has a radio area of 8,500 square feet. Resonance does that for you. Shrink it down to a few feet instead of the normal 132 or 133 feet long, and you get almost that same square feet of area of radio area, even though the shadow on the ground is now going down to square inches instead of a square foot. That's the craziness of resonance. Yes, it doesn't make common sense. The first time you hear it, you're going to say, where in the world is this coming from? What's this guy smoking? I can show you chapter and verse. I can back this up by some of the highly respected experts, and their opinion is verifiable in a laboratory with good test equipment. I say it's traceable to the Bureau. I say you can take it to the bank. That's a strongly felt opinion. So, if he's just bending over the top a little bit, very minor effect. But it's a beautiful compensation for the fact that the tree is not 80 feet tall. The tree may only be 60 feet tall. By bending over the top that way, you get a little bit of mechanical shortening, and you get a way of living with a shortened tree, a less than ideal height tree. Another good engineering technique. I say it's going to work like a charm. Go do it. K2KEY, K2RIW in the deck net.
This is K2KEY. You brought up some very interesting points. If we look at the original Marconi antenna, original what they call the grounded Marconi antenna, which was in the shape of an inverted L. Now, if we take this antenna, what we're just talking about, they said bend over the top 15 feet or so of this vertical section. Bending that over, would that actually create some kind of additional capacitance and would actually make the antenna appear electrically longer, Dick, over?
Absolutely, Mel. As you bend over the top, you're doing two things at once. You're just beginning what I call the zigzagging technique of the wire. The wire doesn't have to be out straight on a half-wave dipole. On a vertical dipole, the vertical wire doesn't have to be straight vertical. Good common sense would say yes. You can zigzag it all kinds of ways. As long as the antenna radiating system, antenna tuner, feed line, antenna, as long as that combination hits resonance, no matter how you zigzag it, you put 100 watts into it, it's going to radiate 99 watts into space somewhere. And the pattern is going to change a little bit, very minor. So when you tilt over the top, you're beginning zigzagging. You're doing a poor man's equivalent of starting to putting on a top hat loading capacitor. A top hat loading capacitor would probably consist of about 6 wires going off in all of the compass directions, parallel to the ground, perpendicular to your main radiator wire. That would be a full top hat capacitor for top hat loading, capacitive loading. And if you only have one wire there, you're beginning the capacitor. You haven't completed it. So is the bending over of the top wire a top-loading capacitor, or is it zigzagging? The answer is yes. It's doing a little bit of both. And mechanically, you're going to shorten it a little bit because you've done that. And so, by sweeping the standing wave ratio measurement at 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, 8, 9, and 4.0 megacycles, you'll look at that bathtub-shaped curve. You'll decide at the bottom of the curve is a little high of your favorite frequency, a little low of your favorite frequency, or right on. And you take the cork off the champagne bottle, you start celebrating, you start pressing the key, and you start working DX. So yes, it's adding a little bit of capacitance, it's adding a little bit of zigzag. Mechanically, it's going to be shortened a little bit because of that. And finding out how much is a fairly simple experiment. And even if it's a little bit off-resonant, you put clip leads and wire on there to make it longer to see what happens, or zigzag a little bit of the middle of it to make it shorter mechanically to see what happens, reestablishing resonance is pretty easy. You're going to get a little bit of capacitive loading from the tree itself. And if you did this on a pine tree versus a maple tree, you're going to get slightly different results. The tree has different diameters, different amount of sap, different length and girth of its branches, different number of leaves, different capacitance of the leaves. You're going to get a little bit of difference, depending on what brand of tree you put this in. But in all cases, you're going to immediately sweep it, see that standing wave ratio bathtub-shaped curve, and electronically you'll know right away what's going on. And like a blind man walking up a hill, you can feel the tilt of your feet, and you know which way is uphill. Well, in your case, you're going to look at the bottom of the bathtub and see what frequency is at, and you're going to know which way to go to make it fall highest desirability of standing wave ratio on your favorite frequency. A fairly simple experiment, a lot of fun to do. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. We're up another good point. First of all, the radials are elevated radials. The ends of these radials are going to have high RF voltage on them. Is that correct, that the tips of the radials are going to be hot, over?
Not really, Mel. If there was only one radial, yes, it would be equally as hot as the radiator. If you've got four radials, you're going to put roughly one quarter of the counterpoise current, one quarter of it into each radial, and because one quarter of the current is going onto each radial, the voltage at the tips will be higher than the center, without a doubt, but it's still going to be small by comparison to the voltage that's on the tip of the radiator, the bent over thing. So there will be some voltage out there. I think you're going to suggest that you keep the tips away from the densest part of the tree and support it out there with an egg insulator and some nylon rope over to a branch. And so don't let the tip lay directly against a branch. If you were about to say that, I'm going to agree with you, Mel. It's not going to stop operating if you wrap it around a branch. But just if you wrap it around a branch, you're going to increase the amount of RF current that's coupled into the sap, and you'll lose a little bit of energy. Again, because of what I know about effective capture area, or radial area, being a big number, 8,500 square feet, compared to the shadow area of the tree and its branches and the girth of its branches, it's not a huge difference, but if you have the wherewithal and you're putting up this antenna and you're serious and you want to get the highest performance out of it, I do recommend keeping the tips, oh, I'm going to pick a number, half a foot or a foot away from the nearest branch. It'll increase the performance a little bit, in my opinion. Back to you, Mel.
I thought of this step, this is K2KY, you know, I figure it maybe be a little arc there but when the tree gets wet. Now, I was thinking of another point that we could look into. The impedance at the base of this ground plane, would it approach 35 ohms? I know he wants to feed it with mini RG8U cable because got to be able to pull it into his window. The tree supposedly is right outside his window. So, if the antenna repeats somewhere would be, I don't know, about 35 ohms, by changing the
radial slope, could he bring, in other words, you know, fooling around with the way the radials come off at that base point? How can I